Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
This is The Sporting Life on ESPN Radio and the ESPN app. Here's Jeremy Schapp.
We're joined by an old friend. We go back a long way. He's the author of a new book, Mr. Met, How a Sports Mad Kid from Jersey Became Like Family to Generations of Big Leaguers. The one and only longtime Mets public relations guru, Jay Horowitz. Jay, thank you for being with us.
Jeremy, it's a pleasure to be with you, really. It's a pleasure to be, speak to anyone with the last name Schapp. It means a lot to me.
Now, Jay, I've got to say, there are a few things that we have to discuss before we even get to the specifics of the book, which is just a treat. But I will confess, I think my first memories, there's no reason for you to remember this. You were very busy in 1986. But in 1986, I was an avid Mets fan, and I tried to go to as many home games as possible, including the playoffs. And there were occasions, Jay, on which I think you might have sneaked me into the press box when I didn't have a ticket. Do you have any memory of this? Is this something you're willing to confess to?
I do. And I tell you what, you can blame your late father for that, Jeremy. Because when I was at Philly Dickinson, and Dick was doing sports on NBC, I used to call him three times a week with all these cockamamie stories, a one-armed fencer, a priest who played hockey, a freshman football player, blah, 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 blah. And Mr. Schapp was nice enough to put him on the air for me. And really, he was kind of responsible for me getting a job at the med school, all the notoriety we got at Philly Dickinson. When I left to go to the Mets, Dick and Jim Bouton were nice enough to MC my going away dinner. It was really just a tremendous thrill for me to have two people like that come in all the way to New Jersey to do something for me. It's something I'll never, ever, ever forget.
Well, he was a big Jay Horowitz fan, and I remember specifically having the conversation with my father about how totally impressive it was, the job you did at Tiny Fairleigh Dickinson. I don't think it was just WNBC. As I recall, I think you pitched him at least two stories about Fairleigh Dickinson athletes, the ones you mentioned, that ended up on the NBC Nightly News with John Chancellor.
Yeah, it was great. Two of my favorites, Jeremy, were we had Franklin Jacobs, who was a high jumper, who jumped 2 feet over his head. He won the Milrose Games 1 year. And we had Steve Dembowski, who was a baseball player, 5'5" guy, who set an NCAA record, who got hit by a pitch 128 times in 4 years. And one spring, we had 11 cameras come out to see us play. He got hit every time for the cameras. It was truly amazing.
We're speaking with Jay Horowitz, who's been working for the New York Mets as their head of public relations, head of communications, now in an emeritus position of sorts for the last couple of years. His new book is Mr. Met, How a Sports Mad Kid from Jersey Became Like Family to Generations of Big Leaguers. Jay, even now, 34 years later, people think about the 86 Mets, of course, because they were world champions. But more than that, they were a collection of characters, and there was drama, and there was off-the-field stuff going on. What was it like being in the middle of that collection of talent and characters?
Jeremy, you never knew what's going to happen when you got to the ballpark that day. Who was going to do what? What's going to happen? You know, I'm going to get called into the office to do something. You know what about all those guys? You know, Darryl and Doc and Keith and Wally. You know, no matter what they did on or off the field, they always stood up in front of the lockers and spoke the truth. And that's why all those guys are so beloved, even today, with all the stuff that went on, and, you know, they just stood there, and, you know, like Darryl and Doc have really turned their lives around. You know, Darryl is a minister. Doc does a lot of good work with high schools and hospitals. It was just a crazy time. I mean, you just never knew. We had visits. Mike Tyson came in and saw us during the year. We probably got like 6 or 7 bench-clearing brawls. And, you know, when Cincinnati won time and Eric Davis slides it to Ray Knight, and Ray Knight gets up and clocks him. I mean, they hated us. They absolutely hated the Mets. And because we were cocky. It really stems with the manager, Davey Johnson. You know, he believed we would win. And I take it back. And after the welcome home dinner in the 86, we were 2-3. after the first two series.
Right.
Davey told the people, don't worry, we're not going to lose many more games the rest of the year. So we lost 51 more games after that from the rest of the year. So it's just really proud. And those guys treated me well. They took me under their wing, and Keith and those guys were great. It, you know, being around them, it's something and I'll never forget.
One of the things I vividly remember, and thanks to you, Jay, I think I was at games 1, 6, and 7 of the World Series, and sitting in the Sports Channel box with Tim McCarver and those guys and Xander Hollander and Ray Robinson and my dad who was working the series. And after game 7, the Mets complete that spectacular comeback in game 6, then come back 2 nights later, win game 7. I have this vivid memory, of being down in the clubhouse, or maybe it was the press conference room, and Mike Torres walks in and he's screaming, I'm off the hook. I'm off the hook. Do you remember that?
I do remember that. Yeah, because that was the famous Bucky Dent home run. You know
yeah, which
mean?
Is a different team. So it was a weird thing, but there were so many things that went on. There were so many great moments with the 86 Mets. You know, and of course we can't talk about those teams that you were around without talking about Gary Carter, the late, great Gary Carter.
Yeah, he was a mensch, as we say in the religion. I mean, that year, I mean, in 2011, you know, I broke my ankle and Gary called me religiously every week. How you doing, Jay? How you doing? You know, this is Kid. How you doing? And this is in the midst where he was just diagnosed with brain cancer. I remember January of the following year, you know, Jeff Wilpon got a plane and we went down to see Gary in his home in West Palm Beach. And, you know, he was really struggling at the time. I'm going to beat this. And what a great guy to be around. You know, I mean, he did so much for the team, but, you know, he was, you know, he just got both ends. His mom, he always thought he was going to die early. Jeremy, his mom died of leukemia, you know, he died at 57 and, you know, just a pleasure to be around. He really was just a great guy, and he did so much on and off the field. It was, you know, really a pleasure to consider him a good friend.
Again, we're speaking with Jay Horowitz. His new book, Mr. Met, How a Sports Mad Kid from Jersey Became Like Family to Generations of Big Leaguers. And I got to say, Jay, I mean, what were the final numbers? 37 years as the head of PR communication?
Well, it was 38 years.
Sorry, I didn't want to shortchange you. I'm sorry. I apologize.
No, this is my alumni director. You know, I mean, you know what I'm doing, Jeremy? I really like what I'm doing. Be honest with you, when Jeff Wilpon first proposed it to me, I wasn't crazy about it because I like the camaraderie in the locker room. I like to travel. But you know what, though? I feel like we're making a difference now because we didn't really reach out to a lot of the alumni. We started with the 50th anniversary, 69 team. Example, a couple of months ago, I called Hobie Landreth on the phone. Hobie's in his early 90s. He was the first pick in the Mets in the 61 wow. draft. And he said to me, I'm the first guy in 50 years from the organization who called him. And that made me feel good. You know, we're letting these guys know we care. Yeah, bring him back into the family. So it's a good thing, you know, and I think we're trying to do some good. We brought him back last year for the home games. They do autograph stuff. And so it's good to reconnect with a lot of these. I work with most of them. That shows how old I am.
I have to say, Jay, one of my biggest regrets in this business is that I could not convince you to do a story for ESPN about your notorious penchant for butt dialing. Former players. I tried. I begged you. You wouldn't do it. So this is the Wall Street Journal. It was first wrote kind of the definitive account.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how I did that, Jeremy. You know, I would keep the phone on me. I would butt dial these crazy guys. I would butt dial Dookie Hernandez.
I was honored. I got butt dialed at like 3 a.m. once. You must have been on the West Coast and you barely ever called me. It was a thrill.
One time I bucked out Dave Magan during the game, and he went to the clock and he said, can't you see I'm at first base? What are you doing calling me? And I didn't even realize he was doing it half the time. I mean, I'm mature now. I have a cell phone now. But you know what I do with my big mistake now is I don't shut the phone off a lot. And sometimes I might say something maybe untoward about someone I just hung up with. And a lot of times the people – I get a call, but I heard that, Jay. Shut your phone off. You know, I'm not mechanically inclined, Jeremy. What can I tell you? I do some things well. I'm not mechanically inclined.
Allow me to be serious for a moment, though.
Yes, sir.
From your, you know, to do the job you did in the maelstrom that is the New York sports media marketplace. And especially with that team over the years, where there were so many controversies and there were great years and there were tough years. I think of 1993, being around the team a lot in 93, which was, you know, an epic failure, as they say now. To what do you attribute? This is the kind of question my dad would ask. To what do you attribute your longevity?
Dad, I never lied. Maybe I didn't tell the truth all the time. I get to try, a good PR guy has to get the players to trust him. You know, and when things are bad, if I would go to play, hey, you got to be in front of your locker. You got to do this. And the players, and it's really, okay, you have three masters. You have the ownership who hired you, the players, and the media. And you got to walk the line. But to exist in the locker room, the players have to know you can be trusted, that they'll have your back. And if things are bad, you know, like I would always tell them, hey, listen, get it over with, you know, be in front of your locker. And I just tried not to lie. And I think all three facets that I dealt with knew that I told the truth and knew that I was a dedicated, loyal men employee and I had everybody's best interests at heart. And that was really enabled me to exist all these years. Because you can't, you know, the market, Jeremy, once you get caught in a lie or you tell somebody something's not true, you lose your credibility. And I think for all these years, I was able to keep my credibility intact. That probably was why I was able to succeed, whatever, to get by for 40 years.
And the title of your book, it really is true. You did become like family to generations of players. And sometimes that's a relationship with a lot of friction, of course. And, you know, there is more media now than ever before. Who are the guys over the years that you became closest to?
Well, everybody asked me that, Jeremy. It's hard to have a 1A. There's a lot of ones, you know, Johnny Franco, David Wright, Gary Carter, Mookie, you know, Al Leiter, Robin Ventura. I was really blessed with, you know, around a lot of good guys, you know, and most of these guys, you know, Doc and Daryl, I'm still friendly with. And you know who really, really had a big influence on my career was Joe Torre, my first manager, like in 1980. Joe always liked to tell people I got him fired the next year. But on our first road trip, he took me to a Thai store on St. Catherine Street in Montreal. He bought me seven of the ugliest ties, these big fat ties. Had to wear them every day. But Joe took me around. He introduced me to Pete Rose, to Reggie Jackson, to everybody. He is our new PR guy, you know. Joe told me what it was to how to get around and how to exist in a locker room, and I'll be eternally grateful to him. But you know, through the years, I can, the other side of it, I can honestly tell you a guy I didn't get along with. Everybody says, "Well, how about Dave Kingman?" You know, Dave Kingman actually lived at my house in Clifton for about 2 weeks, and when he came back to us in 1980, the early 80s, he didn't have a place to live, so I offered him a spare bedroom, and we commuted for about 2 weeks together back and forth to New York, and he paid for the toll.
Notoriously hard to get along with Dave Kingman. I never met him. I don't recall ever meeting him. He was before my time. But, I mean, Dave Kingman, with all due respect, is someone nobody seemed to get along with.
We got him back the second time. It was his idea. He gave out pens to the writers at the press conference. And I just, you know, it goes back to what I said before. I just let these guys that I care, and I try to treat the 25th guy like the number one guy, you know, and not to show any favoritism. Because the guys that pick on them, they're always going to the stars. You know, the 25th guy calls for a favor, you take care of the guy. And the other guys will see how you treat everybody. And that's, you know, but I mean, we were a lot of great guys, you know, in Davey and Bobby Valentine and, you know, Terry Collins and Willie Randolph. And I've been really fortunate. You know, I never got married, Jeremy, and this became my family. And, you know, and I was fortunate enough to be around a lot of good guys.
I have a vivid memory, Jay. You talk about the 25th guy. And again, I'm using the phrase with all due respect. I would say at one point in 1987, I think it was, Bill Allman would have been that 25th guy, right?
Yes, the guy from Brown, right.
Yeah, guy from Brown, number one overall pick, I think, in 74.
Right.
And I have this vivid memory, tell me if I'm imagining this, of him winning a game with a walk-off hit in the ninth of the 10th off Lee Smith, who at the time was the most dominating closer. I mean, there were just those kinds of miraculous moments. The one, you know, in terms of the baseball, the one that still must be tough to take was what happened in 88 with the Dodgers.
That was probably the worst. We were in the ninth inning. I think we're winning. We're 3-1. I forget what the score was. Dwight is cruising along.
Yep.
And he gives up a home run to Socha.
Yeah.
You know, and he got like X amount of batters in a row. And that really, you know, we came back to get it to game 7. But if we had won that game, I think it really, you know, we won 100 games that year. I think we beat the Dodgers 10 of 11 times that year. And that was a crusher. The other one was in 85. I remember when Terry Pendleton hit a home run off of McDowell. Maybe it was 80. I forget what the years were. But the one against, the loss to the Dodgers at Shea Stadium was a crusher. We had won that game, and, you know, it still haunts me today, you know, because we had really dominated during the regular season.
Speaking with Jay Horowitz, the longtime Mets public relations executive. The title of his new book is Mr. Met: How a Sports Mad Kid from Jersey Became Like Family to Generations of Big Leaguers. And I don't want to embarrass you, Jay. I don't want to get all mushy, but I got to say, you know, it always meant a lot to me. And you had the connection with my dad, but, you know, I started off in this business as a young guy working in local TV at New York One right when it went on the air. And I thought you treated everybody with respect. And it must have been at times just a difficult thing to do, to manage the competing interests of the team, the players, and the media. And how did you balance that?
It's a three-headed monster. I always had to remember, you know, the ownership. You had to make sure the ownership was okay with you. You know, the ownership thinks you're partial to the players and the media. The players, you think you're partial to the media. And the media thinks you're partial to the other two people. And it goes back to credibility. I just try to be fair to everybody. You know, I worked for a little bit in a small paper in New Jersey, you know, after I got out of college. And I always try to treat every paper, like they were the New York Times, New York Post, or the Daily News, give them the same courtesies. They had a job to do, and not to just to funnel everything to, you know, to certain papers. Try to treat everybody as equal and take care of all the beat people who traveled with us.
Jay, you know, when you were doing this job, and you were doing it for, so when you started doing this job, I should say, back in 19, how long did you think you could do it when you saw the pace of it and what it required and the total commitment and the travel? I mean, players, if they're lucky, have a 15-year career. If they're very lucky, you were doing this on the road for almost 40 years. How did you manage to sustain it for that long?
You know what, Jeremy? Because it never really was like work to me. You know, I enjoyed it. I had a lot of good friends in the office. We'd socialize, went to, you know, games, the college games at the end of the year. Again, like I say, it never was married. It really became more than a job. It became an existence for me. It was my second family. And it just, you know, I just never, you know, for about 20 or 30 years, I used to work the postseason too, you know, because I enjoyed staying in touch with the National guys. And one year, I forget the year was, when the Phillies beat Tampa Bay in a World Series, I was on the mound in Veterans Stadium, where their park. I was doing interviews with Jimmy Rollins. He says, "What am I doing?" So I stopped doing. I used to work the All-Star game. I just like the competition. I like the travel. I like being around the people. I love the game. I love the game of baseball.
What's the worst press box left in baseball? So many of them have been updated, new stadiums. Is there still a press box that's just too crowded and kind of uncomfortable?
Well, they've improved a little bit. Chicago was always tough. You know, it was a small, the Wrigley Field. But they've done it. Now, most of the press boxes now are really pretty big. But, you know, the Wrigley Field was, the clubhouse was, you know, Wrigley Field was small, but they've expanded a little bit. Milwaukee was small, but they've expanded it. But, you know, most of the stuff is, you know, is pretty modern tech now. But I just remember the clubhouse, you know, Fenway Park during the World Series in 86 was always a tough place to work. You know, we had to walk out to the left field bullpen for the press area, and we used to do the interviews in the runway. I remember every time we played the Red Sox, the cars would come screeching by. You'd have to stand outside with the press, you know, as the beer cans go rolling by. But most of the clubhouses and the press boxes are pretty good now.
Jay, how often do you get out on the road? I mean, nobody's getting out on the road so far this year, obviously, but typically, how much are you out there?
Now I'm really at my home in Clifton. You know, I go for a walk, try to do the right thing. you know, wear my mask and just, you know, hopefully this stuff, you know, we get a vaccine and, you know, all the craziness stops a little bit and we can get back to a little bit semi-normal, you know, and all the, you know, stuff going on and, you know, with the, you know, the protests and everything like that. And it's just a different time in the world right now, you know.
Well, Jay, it's really been a pleasure. I still owe you for all those times you sneaked me into the press box and all the times you helped me out with players.
No. Hey, listen, I have a great affection for the Schaap family, you and your dad, and really, in the truth and honesty, Jeremy, if it wasn't for the exposure that your dad gave me back in the late 70s with putting all my cockamamie stuff on the air and always doing it in a nice way and always taking my phone calls and, you know, he used to say, well, what crazy idea we have today, Jay. That's how he used to start his conversation. And he might, you know, I had a pre, you know what, I knew what he liked, and he liked the offbeat stuff. It didn't make any difference. I came from a small school, and he always really took care of me. And really, for him and Jim Batt to come to my going away dinner was a thrill. Even the stuff I had in going forward with the Mets is still probably one of the top one or two thrills of my life for those two gentlemen to come and, you know, say something to me. It was really nice.
They wrote some pretty good sports books, those guys, between them. Jay, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you for everything you've done for the media and baseball over the last 40 years. Jay Horowitz's book is Mr. Met, How a Sports Mad Kid from Jersey Became Like Family to Generations of Big Leaguers. Thanks, Jay.
Jeremy, thank you for your time and be safe, huh?
I'm Jeremy Schaap, and you can listen to new editions of The Sporting Life every Saturday and Sunday morning on ESPN Radio and the ESPN app, beginning at 6 a.m. Eastern Time.